plea with any of his comrades in jail. So he went there to face death with them. Judge Joseph Eaton Gary refused to let the Chicago 8 be tried separately. A special bailiff, Henry L. Rice, was appointed to find potential jurors. Rice was blunt about where his sentiments lay. I am managing this case, and I know what I'm about. Those fellas are going to be hanged as certain as death. I am calling such men as the defendants will have to challenge peremptorily and so waste their time in challenges. Then they will have to take such men as the prosecution wants. He was going to challenge all of their jurors. And he did. He got the jurors exactly that the prosecution wanted. With the help of Judge Gary, Rice's strategy worked perfectly. Rice is spelled R-Y-C-E. Judge Gary refused to disqualify one potential juror who was a friend of one of the dead policemen and another who admitted not only to being prejudiced against all anarchists, but to being a relative of one of the dead policemen. The defense was forced to use up its challenges on these and other unacceptable potential jurors. The final jury consisted of 12 white males, only one of whom was foreign-born. Five of the defendants had been born in Germany and one in England. Seven jurors were white-collar workers, one an employer of labor, one a commercial capitalist agent, and two were capitalist businessmen. There were no industrial workers. The U.S.'s farce that you have a right to a jury trial by your peers was, as always, denied, and still is today. The prosecution case was flimsy, to say the least, particularly since they had no evidence that any of the defendants had thrown a bomb. And now, later evidence in history has shown that McCormick manufacturers, the big capitalists, had placed the bomb themselves and killed their own police. Capitalists never hesitate to kill their own police that work for them so faithfully, or their own armed forces, have them killed, making them profit in such places as Vietnam. In fact, to this day, it is not known who placed the bomb, but it has been clearly established that the McCormick Manufacturing paid a group, which one of the group that placed the bomb was never brought to light. Prosecution claimed it was Rudolf Schnaubelt, of course, the socialist, and the labor supporters said it was a police provocateur. There's no substantial evidence to support that the socialists were in any way involved, but it was a provocateur hired by McCormick, the big capitalist manufacturer. So the prosecution relied on the conspiracy charge, despite the fact that most of the accused had not even known each other before the trial. So how could they conspire if they hadn't known each other? Conspiracy means meet with to plan something. But so much for rights in USA, they never did exist. The state felt that their most effective tactic was to attack the political ideals of the socialist and anarchist. So they centered on the hypothesis, or the theory, that a general conspiracy had existed in Cook County, Illinois, for several years, which planned to overthrow the government and destroy the legal authority of the capitalist state and capitalist country. Following the logic of the prosecution, it was necessary only to prove that the defendants supported socialism or anarchism to justify convicting them. This was easily done since all of them readily admitted that they were socialist or anarchist. The jury spent 3 hours discussing the case. One-third of the time, or rather two-thirds of the time, devoted to Oscar Niebe, N-E-E-B-E, against whom no real evidence ever was presented. On the morning of Friday, August 20, 1886, the jury gave its verdict, all guilty. Niebe was sentenced to 15 years in prison. The rest were sentenced to be hanged. Immediately after the verdict was read, the defendants were led back to jail. Fielden could not walk without support. Niebe was crushed. Outside the courthouse, a crowd of over 1,000 was ecstatic and let out three cheers. The Christian Salvation Army and other leading Christian groups led the crowd, the mob, who gave three cheers for the jury, for upholding law and order against the atheist, anarchist, and socialist. The citizens of Chicago were relieved, and throughout the nation, capitalist newspapers gushed with pride that the injustice had been done to these great socialists. In October, Judge Gary denied defense arguments for a new trial, and the court, following custom, asked the defendants if there were reasons why sentence should not be pronounced. Indeed, there were. And for 3 days, the 8 socialists and anarchists spoke about their lives, their beliefs, and they thought what they thought of the trial in the mock capitalist system and the evidence that had been presented fraudulently. For 3 days, from October 7 to 9, the accused became the accusers. Spies was the first. Born in central Germany in 1855, he moved to the United States after his father died. He settled in Chicago, where he learned about socialism and ran for office several times before becoming editor of the Arbeiter Zeitung, Arbeiter-Zeitung, a leading socialist newspaper. "If you think that by hanging us you can stamp out the labor movement," said he, "the movement from which the downtrodden millions who toil and live in want and misery, the wage slaves, expect salvation, if this is your opinion, then hang us. Here you will tread upon a spark, but there and behind you and in front of you and everywhere, flames will blaze up. It is a subterranean fire. You cannot put it out." In response to the accusation that the Arbeiter Zeitung had advocated violence, and that this alone was reason enough for them to be hung, spies responded. Let me read to you an editorial which appeared in the Fond du Lac Commonwealth, F-O-N-D, little D-U, capital L-A-C, Commonwealth, in October 1886, a Republican paper. "If I am not mistaken," said the courageous August spies, "the court here is also Republican too. Both the prosecutor and the judge, I understand." "To arms," he read. "Republicans? Every Republican in Wisconsin should go armed to the polls on next election day. The grain-stacked houses and barns of active Democrats should be burned, their children burned, and their wives outraged, and that they may understand that the Republican Party is the one which is bound to rule, and the one which they should vote for, or keep their vile carcasses away from the polls. If they persist in going to the polls, and the niggers that serve them, meet them on the road, in the bush, on the hill, or anywhere, and shoot every one of those bastardly cowards and agitators. If they are too strong in any locality," said the Republican national newspaper, "and succeed in putting their opposition votes into the ballot box, break open the box and tear in shreds their discord-breathing ballots." "Now," said the socialist August spies, "what does your honor say to these utterances of law?" "This, the utterances of a law and order organ, a Republican Party organ." As you know, there are two major parties in USA, Democrats and Republicans, two sides of the same capitalist coin, two complexions of the same capitalist direction. After speaking at great length, the socialist spies concluded with, "I say, if death is the penalty for proclaiming the truth, then I will proudly and defiantly pay the costly price. Call your hangman. Truth crucified in Socrates, in Christ, in Giordano Bruno, in Huss, Gallio still lives. They and others whose numbers are legion have preceded us on this path. We are ready to follow. We are ready to die." Michael Schwab, another defendant in the farcical frame-up of socialists, was born in 1853, had come to Chicago from Bavaria, a state in Germany, when he was 16. Like spies, he took the opportunity to explain his doctrines, and like spies, he used the words communism, socialism, and anarchism as if they meant the same thing. In that day, they did. It was only later brought to light in the great Soviet Revolution. when anarchists opposed Lenin, that they were really people who only were against things but had nothing to replace it. The third defendant to speak was 36-year-old Oscar Nieb, of German descent, but born in New York City. A quiet, simple man, he was just a moderate socialist. Before the 4th of May, he said, I committed some other crimes. My business was yeast peddling, brought me in connection with the bakers. I saw that the bakers in this city were treated like dogs. I said to myself, these men have to be organized. In organization, there is strength. And I helped organize them. That is a great crime, he said. The men are now working, instead of 16 hours, 10 hours a day. And I committed a greater crime than that. I saw in the morning, when I drove away with my team, that the beer brewers of the city of Chicago went to work at 4 o'clock in the morning. They came home at 8 o'clock at night. They never saw their families. They never saw their children by daylight. I went to work and I organized them, said he proudly. Hang me too, for I think it is more honorable to die suddenly than to be killed by inches. I have a family and children. And if they know their father is dead, they will bury him. They can go to the grave and kneel down by the side of it, but they cannot go to the penitentiary and see their dad, who was convicted for a crime that he hasn't had anything to do with. That is all I have to say to you, Judge. I am sorry not to be hung with the rest of the men. 28-year-old Adolf Fischer was born in Bremen, Germany, and arrived in the USA when he was 15. He had become interested in socialism in Germany as a result of a Christian instructor attacking it. I can remember that's how some came to our movement when Kinsolving was attacking us on the flimsiest reasons, not naming that it was really for the fact that we were socialist and had given several thousands of dollars to free Angela Davis. So an attack on socialism brought this young man to socialism at 15 years of age. He said, I protest against my being sentenced to death because I have committed no crime. I was tried for murder, and I was convicted for anarchy or socialism. I protest against being sentenced to death because I have not been found guilty of murder. However, if I am to die on account of being a socialist, I will not remonstrate. In other words, he will not plea for anything. He'll be glad to die as a socialist. The fifth to speak was 22-year-old Louis Ling. Ling, L-I-N-G-G, was the only one of the eight defendants who was actively a violent communist revolutionary. He made bombs, and he was not ashamed to admit it. Born in Mannheim, M-A-N-N-H-E-I-M, Germany, his father died when Louis was only 7 years old. He was apprenticed, sort of like an indentured servant, to a carpenter, traveled to Switzerland, and then came to USA to avoid military service. He addressed the court in German. I do not recognize your law, jumbled together as it is by the nobodies of bygone centuries, and I do not recognize the decision of this capitalist court. I repeat that I am the enemy of the order of today, and I repeat that with all my powers, so long as breath remains in me, I shall combat your capitalist system. You laugh. Perhaps you think you'll throw no more bombs, Ling. But let me assure you that I die happy on the gallows. So confident am I that hundreds and thousands to whom I have spoken will remember my words. And when you shall have hanged us, then mark my words, they will do the bomb throwing. In this hope do I say to you, I despise you. I despise your capitalist order, your capitalist laws, your force-prop capitalist authority. Hang me for it, goddammit. George Engel, E-N-G-E-L, 50 years old, had come to the U.S. in 1873, another of the nine defendants, not too much more. I'm giving you a synopsis of a very, very large book. We see from the history of this country that the first colonialists won their liberty, the first colonists, rather, won their liberty from the colonialism of Great Britain through force, that through force slavery was abolished. And just as the man who agitated against slavery in this country had to ascend the gallows, so almost certainly must we. I hate and combat not the individual capitalist, but the capitalist system that gives him those privileges. Samuel Fielden spoke at great length about his life, his socialist beliefs, and his innocence of any wrongdoing. Next to speak was Albert Parsons, the white Confederate officer who'd married a brave black woman who became, after his death, one of the greatest women socialists of all times. And speak he did. For 2 hours in October 8, on October 8, and 6 hours on October 9, an excellent orator, he took this opportunity of his last public appearance to tell the history of the working class struggle in the United States. He freely admitted his support for the use of dynamite, because today dynamite comes as the emancipator of man from the domination and enslavement of his fellow men. Even though he denied that the working class had used dynamite, he said, "I will not deny the principle of armed struggle. It is democratic. It makes everybody equal." "Now I speak plainly," Parsons says. "Does it follow, because I hold these views, that I committed or had anything to do with the commission of that bombing at the Haymarket?" "No. You capitalists were responsible for that." The last speaker was Judge Gary. In substance and effect, it is that the defendant, Nebe, be imprisoned in the state penitentiary at Joliet at hard labor for the term of 15 years, and that each of the other 8 defendants, between the hours of 10 o'clock in the afternoon, the forenoon, and 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the third day of December next, in the manner provided by the statute of the state of Illinois, be hung by the neck until he is dead. Remove the prisoners from my presence. The verdict was appealed to the state Supreme Court, and then to the United States Supreme Court, which on November 2, 1887, upheld the lower court decision. The execution date was reset for November 11, and the only hope left for the condemned men was an appeal to the governor to commute their sentences. Fortunately, public opinion had changed considerably in the 1.5 years since the bomb had exploded. People of all classes now spoke out in favor of the socialist and the anarchist, and the cause had even spread to France and England. In London on October 14, a large mass meeting was addressed by a diverse set of speakers, including socialist William Morris, anarchist philosopher Peter Kropotkin, K-R-O-P-O-T-K-I-N, playwright socialist George Bernard Shaw, and the theosophist Annie Besant, B-E-S-A-N-T. Attempts were made to convince the prisoners to submit written pleas for mercy, because public pressure was growing. But only Fielden, Schwab, and Spies would do it. On November 6, Ling's cell was searched, and 4 small bombs were discovered that had been placed there by the police to incense the public. Although the explosives were only large enough for self-destruction, the discovery brought about an increased fear of an anarchistic revolt, a socialist revolt, and damaged the movement. The press played it highly, so it damaged the movement to obtain clemency for the prisoners. Ling claimed to have never seen the bombs before, and there was every speculation since by those that have studied the case that they had been planted there by the prison guards and paid for by the manufacturers, the McCormick manufacturers. Conspiracy again of the big capitalists, the big newspapers, like we saw in the attack against us. On November 8, Governor Oglesby received petitions with 200,000 signatures urging him to spare the lives of the condemned socialist and anarchist. All day he met with prominent people who were supporters of commutation, that means revoking their sentence, including members of the state legislature. Nobody now in any state legislature or Congress in the USA that would support a socialist or an anarchist. And even Samuel Gompers, G-O-M-P-E-R-S, the president of the American Federation of Labor, was there to get their sentences commuted. The next day it was announced that Judge Gary and prosecuting attorney Grinnell, G-R-I-N-N-E-L-L, had petitioned the governor to commute the sentences of Fielden and Schwab, Oglesby met with more prominent citizens and was read a letter from Parsons, the white man married to the black woman, which said that he had been found guilty of murder simply because he had attended the Haymarket meeting. This being the case, Parsons requested a reprieve. He knew what it meant to leave his wife and children, she being black and they being mixed, in racist America. So Parsons said, "I was only convicted for being present at a meeting. I did nothing wrong." So he requested a reprieve so that his wife and children, who had also been at the meeting, could be indicted, convicted, and put to death together with him, because he knew he was the only one that would take care of him. The governor, when he heard this, Governor Oglesby, exclaimed, "My God, this man is terrible." And that decided his fate. He decided not to commute Parson because of his arrogance. Shortly before 9 on the morning of November 10, Louis Ling placed a small bomb in his mouth and threw off the bottom half of his face, blew it entirely to shreds. He died 6 1/2 hours later, unconscious. At 7 p.m., Governor Oglesby announced that he would commute to life imprisonments the sentences of Fielden, Schwab, but that spies, Parsons, the brave white man married to the black woman, Ingle, and Fisher would die on schedule the next day. November 11, 1887. The night before the execution, before going to sleep at 2 a.m., Albert Parsons chilled the prison guards with a moving rendition of Annie Laurie. The condemned men were completely composed, and their jailers were much disturbed and very impressed. At 11:30 a.m., the four socialists were taken from their cells and cloaked in white muslin shrouds, muslin, white muslin shrouds, and led handcuffed to the scaffold. 200 people watched as the nooses were placed around their necks. Fisher helped to adjust his. August spies complained that his noose was too tight, and then gave a thank you when it was loosened. The nervous silence which covered the room was shattered suddenly as August spies' voice boomed out from beneath the hood which covered his head. "There will come a time when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you strangle today," Fisher shouted. Next, "Hurrah for socialism!" Ingle shouted, "Hurrah for anarchy!" Fisher came then. "This is the happiest moment of my life." Parsons just started to speak. "Will I be allowed to speak? Oh, men of America, let me speak. Sheriff Matson, let the voice of the people be heard." And at that moment, the trap was sprung, and their lives were snuffed out for their valiant stand for socialism in the Haymaker affair, the Haymarket affair of 1886. The last few words I'll give have to do with the funeral. On Sunday, November 13, 1887, Chicago, Illinois, saw the largest funeral in its history. Mayor Roche, R-O-C-H-E, ordered that no banners, flags, or arms be displayed, no music be played other than dirges, and that there be no demonstration or speeches. At least 16,000 people marched behind the five coffins, while over 250,000 people lined the entire route. You couldn't get 25 people out for socialists today. Only one banner was carried, an American flag proudly held by Civil War veterans. Over 10,000 persons observed the simple burial at the graveside at Waldheim Cemetery. The final chapter in the story of the Haymarket affair came in 1893 when Illinois' new governor, John P. Altgeld, A-L-T-G-E-L-D, severely damaged his career by pardoning Fielden, Neeb, and Schwab. What hurt his career was not that he pardoned the men, but the reason for which he pardoned them. He was too honest. No politician, no public official can last and be honest. Governor Altgeld ALTGELD, after studying the case carefully, declared that the socialists and anarchists should be freed because they were innocent, as were the five who lay in their graves at Waldheim, W-A-L-D-H-E-I-M. He said that the jury had been packed, and he personally attacked Judge Gary for being an insidious, devious, dishonest judge, and also that he was prejudicial in every way. Altgeld was viciously condemned by all of the major newspapers in the United States, and he was hung in effigy throughout the country, but he refused to respond to any of the criticisms. He said, "Remember this about any slander," said Governor Altgeld. He said to a friend, "Denial only emphasizes and gives added importance to falsehood. Let it alone, and it will die for want of nourishment." Some thought we need to take to consideration there, even though the governor was pushed out of his office, didn't win again. It's a thought to think about. The author of the book that I have just given you, David Wallenschinsky, W-A-L-L-E-C-H-I-N-S-K-Y, has recently had two books published, Chico's Organic Gardening, Natural Living, and Laughing Gas. This is his only serious book, and of course it was much, much, much larger than what I gave you. That is your special today, to have that historical U.S. experience in your backlog of reference. The Haymarket Affair that won the 8-hour day strike in USA, but nothing more, because USA has not moved one bit since then, and in fact, socialism has lost its support vastly since those days in USA. Much love. Into the 20s now, the death toll has risen, and over 150 that have been injured, many of them seriously. Strangely enough, there's a great deal of silence, unwillingness to even make a fall guy for the provocateurs. Perhaps it didn't work out to suit them. Some strange mystery anyway. An ice cream truck equipped with a bomb blew up. Or perhaps the USA has decided that there's too much danger that they cannot calculate the moods, although one cannot really speculate, because there could be nothing more apathetic and appallingly apathetic or in despair than the U.S. public. Nonetheless, nothing new has been brought to light. The purpose behind the bombing in the Wall Street financial empire that took into the 20s of death tolls from being burned alive.